Hello, and welcome to this month's interview for members of Steve Harrison's Million Dollar Author Club. You're about to hear Steve interviewing John Graydon, world kickboxing champion and the best-selling author of Black Belt Management and The Imposter Syndrome, on how he turned his book into over $30 million in revenue.
I remember when you came to me at the summit, you said that you had had a book from the past that you had done a lot with and you thought would be a good interview for, you know, the Million Dollar Author Club.
Yep.
And that's kind of what got us here, you know, connected tonight. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, what you did with it? What are some of the steps involved in that?
Sure. The book was Black Belt Management, and I wrote it in 1993. Let me just rewind the tape a little bit. I started my martial arts training in 1974. I knew from my first day in class that I was going to do this for the rest of my life, and I'm still at it. Around 1986, I opened my first school. And in those days, the schools were kind of, martial arts schools were kind of like what I called dungeon dojos. They were rough, smelly places where guys, it was very rough. It was more like military training than a family-oriented program that we see today. So within about 6 months, I was flat broke. My school was about to go under. So I started to study the schools around the country that were doing two things. One, the owner was making a six-figure income from the school, and two, the school produced excellent black belts, because that was so important to me. I didn't want to sacrifice quality to try and make this thing work. So I started to find out the essential key elements that these guys were doing in their schools, and I started to apply these to my own school. Within about 6 months, I turned it around. Within 18 months, I, too, with about 300 students with a six-figure income. So I figured there's a lot of guys that would be interested in learning these same systems, so I wrote a book in 1993 called Black Belt Management. And Black Belt Management was published, self-published as a three-ring binder manual, which allowed me to charge $149 per copy. And I sold nearly 1,000 of them in the next 18 months. And the book was a monster success in the very small industry. I paid my house off. And then I was actually at a convention in Las Vegas talking about the book, promoting the book, Black Belt Management. And the host of the convention approached me with a box of business cards. On the cards, it said, John Graydon, President, National Association of Professional Martial Artists. He said, John, you're the only guy that can do this. With that vote of confidence, I created the first professional association for the martial arts industry and the first trade journal. And I launched that in December of 1993 by sending out 700 sample boxes. The way the program would work is that it's, if you became a member of NAPMA, you became a member of my association, you paid $99 per month, and each month you received in the mail a box. And in that box was a videotape with drills and business tips, ads that you could use to promote your school, a newsletter you could send out to your students, and various marketing and management tips and help. I sent 700 sample boxes out, 130 schools enrolled the following week, and the organization just grew from there to eventually it peaked at about 2,200 schools when I sold the organization in 2004. So during that period of time, using the launching point of the book, none of this would have happened had I not written Black Belt Management. None of this wouldn't happen if I had not actually attended seminars with Dan Pointer back in those days and Mark Victor Hansen's, I don't think he called it the mega book marketing seminar in those days. But doing that little bit of research and pulling the trigger on the book, I was able to generate over $30 million and change an entire industry over the course of the next decade.
Hmm. So it's really how to turn, that's really a great story. That's really exciting. How to turn a book into over $30 million.
Yep, and literally lead an unlicensed profession. When I say unlicensed, that means that anybody can open a martial arts school with any background. They could come out of college, they could come out of prison, it doesn't matter. So in the martial arts, it's very steeped in tradition. They like to keep things the way they are. So for me to have the ability to actually bring this industry from the Stone Age into the modern age, I mean, it went kicking and screaming. So this is really, the book was the launching point to allow me to create that level of influence. And the book also was, you remember John Kramer? I think you, did you buy his company, Book
yeah.
Market?
Mm-hmm. Book
yeah.
Marketing, yep.
Yeah, he... based on Black Belt Management, he put me in his self-publishing Hall of Fame as well. I just thought about that earlier today. I forgot about that. But that was kind of interesting.
You're very,
for a guy who dropped out of, for a guy who dropped out of high school. Well, I didn't major in any English classes. I mean, I was raised on comic books. I didn't graduate high school. I didn't have any formal training. I just had a desire. And one of the things that I teach in my seminars is the importance of developing a sense of urgency. Get on with it. Attack, attack, attack. And that's essentially the Cliff Notes version of the story.
Wow. I love it. I love it. Prior to writing the book, had you ever written a book before?
No. As a matter of fact, I've been an avid reader throughout my life. My father, actually my parents were avid readers, and on Saturdays we'd be able to go to the bookstore, and it was a big deal. It was a lot of fun. You could pick out two paperbacks and two comic books. And that was just one of the things as a family we did together. So I always grew up around books. I was an avid reader, but I was never trained as a writer. And if you'd have told me in high school that I was going to be writing books and doing the things that I've done, I would have thought you're crazy.
Did you graduate from high school?
I didn't, in fact. I did not. I majored in martial arts. And what I mean by that is I started doing martial arts at age 14, and I knew right away this was my calling. I was going to do this forever. So I literally started skipping school and going to the karate school instead. In 12th grade, I missed something like 54 days of school in one semester. It was bad. It had the exact opposite of what martial arts should have. Martial arts should give you the discipline to follow through. But I was just so martial arts crazed that I was at that school all the time because I knew I was going to do martial arts forever, and I'm still at it.
What kind of success did you achieve in martial arts?
Well, a number of different levels. Shortly after dropping out of high school, I started teaching accredited karate at the local college. So I was teaching college for a period of time. That was a lot of fun. I was doing that with my instructor, Walt Bone. In fact, kind of an odd side story, I was very close to him. I was his highest-ranking black belt. And then in December of 1982, I drove him to the airport where he was going to go home to Dallas to visit his family. I came back to the house, walked in, told my roommate I'll never see him again. 7 days later, he died in a plane crash. And that really forced me to step out on my own. It forced me to step out and really consider doing this as a living. I mean, when you're in your 20s, you don't have, people don't expect a lot of you when you're a young guy in your 20s. You don't have a lot of expenses. You don't have a lot of needs. So it was a very fun lifestyle for me, but that was a devastating point. It pushed me kind of in the direction of making this my career. A lot of people encouraged me, in fact, to open a school. They kept saying, John, you're such a good teacher. You ought to open a school. You can make a lot of money. I was never motivated by money. I was, however, motivated by lifestyle. I loved the idea of the freedom that doing martial arts for a living gave me. But eventually, I did, in fact, open the school in 1986, and I enrolled 125 students in the first 6 weeks. Most of them were transfers from my college classes. But in those days, the classes were awfully rough, and I ended up running most of them off in a short period of time. And that was the inspiration for the book. I had to figure out how to make this business work. So I started to study the schools around the country that were literally producing excellent black belts, and the owner was enjoying a six-figure income. That was the criteria. And I called these guys up, and I would interview them, and I would visit their schools, and I would study and watch. And eventually, I started to realize there are certain key elements that were in place in all of these various schools. It didn't matter what style of martial arts they did, whether it was taekwondo or kickboxing, whatever. There were certain key elements of running the business that I started to apply to my school. In a short period of time, I was able to turn the school around, and over the course of a few years, I too had that six-figure income, and then eventually over 600 students at two different schools. And that was the origins of the book, because I figured that the other guys in the same situation as me that would like to learn these processes for running their school. So I wrote the book Black Belt Management in 1993, and that kind of started everything. Up until that point, I competed a lot. I was a fighter and coach for many world champion United States karate teams. I was able to fight in Germany and London and Italy and all over the place. So the martial arts has been very good to me, to say the least.
This is really, you're sharing a model that people could use in a niche that, you know, where there aren't licensed, you know, participants. And the idea of, you know, trying to solve your own problem by writing a book and interviewing people who've been very successful at doing the very thing you want to do is, I think, a key point here. I think one thing people might be wondering, John, is, you know, how did you contact these owners of martial arts schools and ask them point blank, are you making at least a six-figure income?
Well, some guys were a little more forthcoming than others, and I don't know exactly how many of them really told me the truth. I had to go with my gut because it's not a very big industry, and in a period of time, you kind of know who the more successful school owners are. You know the guys who are driving the nicer car, that are living the kind of lifestyle that you want to aspire to. So as a fighter, especially as a pretty well-known fighter, you know, at age 23, a martial arts magazine did a cover story on me and called me an acknowledged karate master. I thought, how could you do that at 23? I mean, I'm just getting started at this. But the point is, and this is really important, later when I launched the Martial Arts Trade Association, the Martial Arts Professional Association, NATMA, the key for me to influence these school owners was the fact that they knew I was a really good black belt. In other words, I was not just in it for the money. My history through the years of being a world kickboxing champion and coach, they knew that I was the real deal. And if I can convert my dungeon dojo into 600 students and a six-figure income, then they were going to listen. So the key strategy that I pulled from the martial arts to allow me to influence this, again, unlicensed profession where you had people that could be coming out of college with an MBA or coming out of prison and opening schools, the key was to align and redirect. And this is a principle we use in the martial art of Aikido, where we're using someone's energy and then re-guiding that energy in the direction we want them to go in. So it was critical for me to help these guys realize that I was not going to teach them how to rip students off. I was not going to teach them how to become a belt factory or a McDojo, as we say in the industry. I was going to help them improve the quality of their students while improving the quality of their life, giving them the opportunity to retire with a life of dignity like all their friends will be doing, who have real jobs, so to say. So that was a real key element in my ability to reach these guys. Because some other guys had tried to do the professional association, and they tried to do the professional trade journal, but it was clear that these were agenda-driven organizations, and the agenda was all about money. And the subtitle to my book, Black Belt Management, was How to Achieve Success Without Selling Out. And that subtitle was really key. Guys told me over and over again that's what prompted them to purchase the book. And since then, I've written probably six books, and I just did my first one, which is a non-martial arts book called The Imposter Syndrome, which is more of a mainstream self-help thing, but the rest of them have all been in the martial arts realm.
And I think you also bring up a good point, too, about how you know you can take a binder, a three-ring binder, this isn't a bound book, and rather than getting $20 for it, you could get $149 for it.
That is that's all perception, and it's wacky.
Can you explain how many pages was in the binder?
Well, you know, this is what I discovered, Steve, especially as a newbie. If you put a lot of pictures in it and you run the gutter really wide, so you're really only basically running one column down each page, you can get 200 pages out of it. So in other words, I padded that thing as best as I could to really make it feel heavy. I mean, it had great information, great material, but it was not a big book by any stretch of the imagination. But there is a perception that if a book is in a three-ring binder, now it becomes a manual. And for some reason, it has more value. So I was selling hundreds of these things. I was in, the Springs, Palm Springs in California, teaching us at a little mini convention for martial arts school owners. The first time I ever showed the book to anybody. And the guy who was running it knew that I was going to be really good at this. And he kept pushing me off until finally he let me speak to the crowd in the last 15 minutes of the final day. And I mentioned the book. I had probably 25 copies with me. It sold out immediately. I mean, instantly, $149 a piece. A lot of the guys said that they weren't going to leave until the following evening. And if I could have some overnighted, they would buy them on the spot because they wanted it to be able to read on the airplane flying home. So I sold 40, 50 books at $149 a piece on a 15-minute presentation. And that same book now sells for $19.95 as a perfect bound regular old book.
Oh, wow. So eventually you got it out of, you reduced the price.
Eventually I moved it into something that I use as a bonus when people join my organization. So when I created the National Association of Professional Martial Artists in 1994, when you became a member of that organization, and the book is what led to this organization.
I think some people might wonder about, you met this guy and he had the business cards, and just in general, people might wonder, well, how do I form an association? What are some of the steps involved in that?
Interestingly enough, the process for forming an association is pretty much the same as forming any other for-profit business. Now, I would recommend in most cases that if you're going to form an association, there may be some kind of feeling that you ought to turn it into a nonprofit, and I would encourage you not to do that. Of course, I'm not your attorney or your CPA, and check with those professionals, but I simply called it the National Association of Professional Martial Artists. I came up with the logo. I registered as an S-Corp, and I was up and running. It was an association because I called it one. It was an association because when I communicated to the industry, I always spoke about growing the industry, the steps that we're taking to improve this industry, the steps we're taking to make it easier for you to attract and keep students within your school. So I took that very seriously, and a lot of the guys I've seen through the years that either they tried to do what I did or they did smaller associations for their own schools, they became ego-driven, personality-driven organizations. And it was very important early for, in my mind, to make NAPMA work, that it could not be the John Graydon Show. It could not be me on the cover every week and on every other page of the magazine. It had to be the National Association of Professional Martial Arts, and it had to stand on its own. And that took a little while, but for the most part, all I did in terms of visibility is I would appear occasionally in the videos to teach segments that I was particularly good at, and I'd have an editorial in the magazine each month. Beyond that, I'd really just recruited the top talent in the industry to contribute their knowledge and their background to the association in trying to make it as inclusive as possible. In the martial arts in those days, schools were like little islands separated from each other and not communicating with each other. There's a tremendous amount of stylistic bias and stylistic pride in the martial arts. I'm a Taekwondo guy. I'm a Kung Fu guy. These guys really make a strong emotional connection to their systems when they are so committed to the arts that they're doing this for a living. So they wouldn't even talk to each other. They wouldn't support each other. And so what I like to do, I likened it to I was running phone lines from island to island. I was helping these guys come together and communicate and share, because I knew that we all had the same problems. We all had the same problems of trying to attract students and keep students. And once I could keep them on that, style didn't matter. So
you mentioned earlier that your book is what launched everything. And what was your main way, what were the main ways of selling the book and when it was in binder form? Was it mainly through speaking?
Yes. I aligned myself, I positioned myself with various organizations that had either big mailing lists or they hosted events. And eventually one of the companies, actually a number of them, recognized that I was a good speaker and it would help their image to promote events with me on the stage. So we would go literally city to city where I would get up and make an hour presentation, and then they would get up and talk about their services, and I would come back with another hour presentation, and then I would sell books from the back of the room. It was a whole lot of fun, frankly. And it began to build my name in that new arena, because this was a really, in many ways, virgin territory. Again, some guys had tried it before, but they really came in just hungry for the money. I was all about improving the art.
And these people would, that you teamed up with, they did all the work promoting the seminars?
They would promote the seminars. They would host it, make the hotel arrangements, everything. It was a beautiful sponsorship deal, and I had a number of different organizations that did that with me.
Now, were they companies typically that were selling? Can you give people an idea so they can picture?
Sure. In the industry, you have companies that sell equipment. Mm-hmm. You have companies that provide services for schools, such as collecting and processing students' tuition, which will be called a tuition billing company. And those are the kind of companies that wanted to align with me. These were companies that needed to develop trust with the school, especially if you're talking about a billing company who's going to be collecting the students' tuition. That's a delicate area when you're talking about finances and the income of the school. So they knew that with me at the front that I would help build those bridges, which I did, and it worked beautifully. And the association, I had it for 10 years before I sold it, and again, it generated over $30 million. And I think the key to the association, really, and I knew this very early going in, was the launching of a professional association magazine. I launched Martial Arts Professional Magazine in the first year or second year, I can't call exactly, of the association. And what that did was allowed me to reach the rest of the industry, let them know about the association, let them know what we're doing. Many of them would never join, but I could still influence them. I could still help them and create goodwill and help grow the industry. Hmm. And that was a 72-page full-color magazine in Time. It was published every month and distributed to about 20,000 schools.
Wow. And free of charge or that was like a free mailing list, free circulation?
Right. It's called a professional control distribution. So you're sending it only to martial arts school owners because it was more important for my advertisers to reach as many schools as possible than it was for me to get, you know, $3 or $4 for the cover.
Exactly.
For the cover price. So by increasing the circulation, keeping the circulation numbers high, I was able to get a better dollar for the advertisers and get them a better return. And frankly, create more influence for myself and the organization.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're also doing, you also did something that I teach too, which is the idea of, you know, figuring out the path. You know, who else is your customer that you're trying to sell to? Who are they buying from, or who's trying to sell to them? And in this case, you were teaming up when you're doing the speaking with, you know, companies that obviously wanted to get in front of these martial arts school owners as well, and yet you were providing something they couldn't provide, which is the how to actually grow your business.
Well, certainly, and if you're a tuition billing company and you're going to get 10% of the tuition you collect, and I take a student's, I take a school from 50 students to 250 students, well, that's a 5 times increase for that tuition billing company. Everybody benefits. So it was a true win-win situation, and those kind of alignments, that type of positioning is critically important, I think, for any budding author or speaker. Right now, I'm working with a group of some serious high achievers, and I'll give you a short chronology of how this came about. About 2 months ago, I was driving to the airport with my girlfriend, and I checked my messages, and I got a message, and this guy said that he'd watched my John Graydon TV videos at johngraydon.com, and he was so impressed that he wanted to personally call me and invite me to join this, it's like a coalition. These guys are putting together people of influence in various industries to help create a teen fitness movement to fight teen obesity, which certainly I am all over. And he said that his close friend, Dr. Mehmet Oz from the Oprah Show, is going to be in this organization, and he was going to send the links to Dr. Oz. And last week, we did a conference call with this guy and a few others, including Gary Carlton from Women's Fitness Magazine, and he said that he had shown the clips to Dr. Oz and that they'll be calling me about coming up to New York to do the Dr. Oz show probably in the first quarter of next year. So, again, you really don't want to be the rugged individualist out there as an author. It's critically important that you're aligning yourself with organizations and people that can help you reach a larger audience.
Now, you mentioned some other books that you've written. I know the latest is The Imposter Syndrome. Tell people, because I think authors and speakers and coaches that are, you know, in my Million Dollar Author Club, I think they can relate to this concept.
Well,
Go ahead and tell people what that is.
Yeah, the first time I heard about this, I wasn't named The Imposter Syndrome, but I saw Paul Newman in an interview, and he said he always has this feeling that someone's going to come through the crowd one day, grab him by the arm and take him away and say, it's over, Newman. It's all been a mistake. You're coming back to paint houses. When I saw that, I immediately knew exactly that feeling. I said, oh, man, I know exactly what he's talking about. 20 years later, I'm at a hypnosis convention, and I tell that same story to someone, and she goes, oh, that's called the imposter syndrome. I wrote my thesis on it. I said, oh, my God, you're kidding me. There's a name for that? And so the imposter syndrome is the feeling that you're not as smart, talented, or skilled as everyone else thinks you are. It's a feeling that you've been faking it and you might be found out at any time. And certainly with authors. I mean, when you go to Amazon.com and you see, okay, you've got 9 reviews, and you kind of, you know, close your eyes and slowly open them and hope they're all 5 stars. So authors face the imposter syndrome a lot, and the imposter syndrome comes out of, in many ways, your conditioning or programming in childhood that helps you create a certain model of the world. It's how you view the world. And in time, that leads to certain patterns of thought and behavior that end up defining your life. So when I'm teaching a seminar on the imposter syndrome, I'll ask the students to write down some of their mental rules, some of their shoulds. And the imposter syndrome is particularly prevalent in high-achieving women and students and even athletes. There's a lot of athletes that just play to not look bad. They don't really play to win. Because if they win, you'll expect them to do it again, and that's when you'll find out they're not as good. So some of the mental rules that you'll hear the students recite to the class is, I should never raise my hand, because then I'll look like I don't know what I'm doing. I should not ask for help. I should always get it right. If I was so smart, this would be a lot easier. So they're creating these virtually impossible rules in order to continue their life. And you know, a very common one is, I should put everyone's feelings and thoughts in front of my own. And in time, this type of mindset, this model of the world, creates tremendous stress in your life. If your happiness is dependent upon everyone else around you being happy, you're certainly, that's a recipe for stress and frustration. So the imposter syndrome, because I'm not a psychologist, I don't really play one in the book, I simply tell my story. Over 20 years ago, I was already having these feelings because all my friends were going to college, they hated their jobs, they had no time, they had no money. I was working 3-4 hours a night teaching karate. I always had money in my pocket and lots of free time. So at first I loved it, but in time I started to think, this can't be right. And that's a classic imposter syndrome. I don't deserve the success. Another classic imposter syndrome symptom. In fact, then I went up to a karate tournament in Gainesville and went there a day early to have lunch with a friend, and I told her these exact feelings, and she looked me right in the eyes and said, John, I know you. You wouldn't have it any other way. And in many ways, she gave me permission to kind of design the life that I wanted. It was a big moment for me. And all that is all part of the imposter syndrome, which, you know, anybody can kind of explore with me at johngraydon.com, because I have some videos up there and some more information in the book.
It's John Graydon. Spell that out for people.
JohnGraydon.com. And Steve, I want to thank you in particular for your event up in Manhattan. My girlfriend and I were up there. We had a blast. And I made a number of great connections. One of them was with Rick Frieschman from Morgan James Publishing. And they are going to publish the Imposter Syndrome and my next book. So I'm
that's
excited
great.
About that.
Oh, that's
yeah.
wonderful. Now, let me ask you this question. Is there something that you see that you have learned from your experience in martial arts that carries over into business success, author success, you know, entrepreneurial success?
A number of things. Number one, the one I used earlier, this idea of aligning and redirecting. Mm-hmm. Critically important, a great concept. Rather than meet force with force, if I can align with the person I'm trying to persuade, it's a lot easier for me to direct them in the direction that we'll both end up wanting to go in. The other is, and this is kind of odd really, but I'm a big believer in offense. You know, technically I was a counter fighter. The way that I used to fight, I was a counter fighter because I would wait, let the guy make his move, and that would counter his move. Mm-hmm. But over and over again, the greatest champions were guys that really had excellent offense and excellent defense. And that means being able to pull the trigger. So I liken that in the business world, in the writing world in particular, is to develop a sense of urgency. Get it done, get it done, get it done. Attack, attack, attack. Often we get caught in analysis paralysis, where we're taking seminar after seminar, reading book after work, waiting for the perfect alignment of the stars to finally pull the trigger on our project. And what I've learned through the years is the first thing I do now is I check if there's a domain name, at least most of the time I do. I check to see if the domain name is available, and I'd tear right into the project immediately. And that doesn't mean don't research, because I'm certainly a big seminar attendee. My education is primarily studying people like Brian Tracy and Anthony Robbins and those guys. That's a big part of my education. But what I have learned to do is that action creates momentum. Motion leads to emotion. And the sooner you get going in the project, the sooner you pull the trigger, the sooner you're going to get it completed. Because odds are, I want to caution you with this. You know, it doesn't mean that planning is not a good idea, mm-hmm. but pull the trigger. Get on with it. I think that's critical.
Kind of get going, because then you'll be motivated to do the plan.
It really is, because, you know, in the martial arts, we talk about set point. The person, I'm in position to punch or kick you. You're in position to punch or kick me. Whoever moves first wins. Whoever pulls the trigger first wins. And the biggest sin in the fight game is to stand on that line and wait. Mm. And, boy, when that happens, you get clocked.
Wow. Interesting. You know, my uncle went to Virginia Military Institute, and he said when he studied all the generals in war, Robert E. Lee, and the history of just generals, the biggest mistake you could make in battle is to not do anything, just to kind of stay where you are,
That would be it. Absolutely.
Interesting.
And the other thing I would say, and how martial arts helped me, is by becoming a teacher. Really, I never wanted to be a world champion. I never wanted to be the champion. I wanted to be the best teacher possible. So I would go to these competitions, I would go around the world, study the different styles, study the different champions, so that I could come back and become a better teacher with my students. And to this day, I'm studying communication skills. I have a new program coming out that I'm just in the final steps of how to become a powerful, persuasive, and influential speaker, because the two things in today's world you really have to have, especially as an author, is one, obviously you have to learn to write well, but two, you have to learn to speak. It's critically important that you learn to speak well and create. I mean, look at our new president, Barack Obama. He won the presidency purely on his ability to persuade, his ability to speak, his ability to inspire the desire for change in our country. It's been remarkable, but it's a great example of the importance of learning how to speak well and communicate effectively.
Great point. And let me ask you this: what would your suggestion be to authors who really wanted to kind of be committed to doing something every day to promote themselves? If you were to give people some exercises, so to speak, and kind of put on your martial arts hat for a second, just some exercises of what to do to be better marketers.
Well, I think step number one, top of the list, is this. I may ask you what you do. You say, I'm an author, I write books, I speak. No, you are in the sales and marketing business. That is what you do. You're in the sales and marketing business. Your job is to attract readers, attract people to first get to know you through your book so they can then learn to follow you, learn to like you, learn to be inspired by your work, so that you can then move them into either your coaching program or some advanced programs you have. You have a Quantum Leap program. I've been doing a Quantum Leap program for years. So the book works as a great ticket into your arena, but it only works if you're out there getting it into the hands of potential readers. So, for instance, the rest of this year, and this is December 2nd, so the rest of this year, I'm going to lock myself up in my place, and all I'm going to work on this for the rest of the year is creating product. I'm going to wrap up this speaking program. I have a couple other products I want to put together, so I'm going to be either writing, recording, and creating products so that when January 1st hits, I've got the product creation behind me, and now my focus is sales and marketing. My focus now is doing every possible media. There is no media so small that I won't talk to them. There's no event that I won't go speak at. And in many cases, I'm paid for the speaking. In many cases, I'm not. But getting in front of that audience, getting them into my circle, sometimes even just getting their email and physical address is really the payoff I need to move these products in my experience.
Now let's come back to your the book that you did. It was called The Black Belt.
Black Belt Management.
Black Belt Management, right. And so you did that book. You sold that. It was a three-ring binder. Just to review, you sold it for $149, sold over 1,000, largely through speaking. And,
yes.
And then you formed the association, National Association of Professional Martial Artists,
mm-hmm.
where the membership for that, was the membership $99 per month?
Per month, yes.
Per month. And as you said, they got a video with some drills, and the drills were both some how-to martial arts stuff, but also mainly business building advice.
Certainly, how to answer the phone, how to deal with objections, how to explain the benefits of your school and the benefits of the martial arts, which I encourage the reader, the listeners out there concerning their own book. And this is one of the things that was really drilled into us by the coaches at your event up in Manhattan. Who is the reader of your book, and what is the benefit of reading your book? What am I going to get out of this? And it's really specific, and to be able to convey the benefits is a critical skill in whether you're writing a book or running an association. The association also, it was very important to help these guys get a sense of belonging with the organization. So we would do regional seminars where our members would get a discount, and then eventually built into doing national conventions. I had conventions with up to 2,000 attendees. And in fact, Anthony Robbins did my last keynote in 2003. He did it via video from Germany, actually. He walked out to the camera, bowed to the camera, and said, "Hello, NATMA." And he did that gratis for me. I've been kind of working through his organization for many years. In fact, I had a TV show for about 10 years locally in the Tampa Bay area called the USA Karate, and he was on 3 episodes. And I think Brian Tracy was too. I'm not entirely sure, but those videos are also floating around YouTube somewhere. But those events were real important to help create that sense of belonging, which is important.
And so you built that association up, and then you you mentioned that the one of the ways you got members was that you sent 700 sample boxes, essentially, out.
They were, exactly. I hooked up with a martial arts building company that let me use their mailing list.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, I spent literally all night packing these boxes, literally through the night. And in the box was a videotape. And it would have examples of the types of drills that we would teach and the types of, for instance, sales scenario role plays we would do where we would answer the phone and how do you deal with the price questions and how do you enroll a student and what's the best way to do an introductory course and a trial program. And then we'd had sample ads, for instance. It'd be, in the past, in the martial arts, guys had always tried to do things, so to say, on the cheap. And I knew with NAMA I wanted to do something completely different. So I really recruited a great art director and came in with top-level quality material. So our ads looked better than any ads ever in the industry. And they were really strong ads, and they helped guys to attract a lot of students into their school. And this is an interesting sidebar, Steve. My first art director, and this is how guys who are listening to this, guys and gals, can replicate what I did, because my art director did exactly that. My art director was Scott Kelby. He was a local graphic design guy back in the early 90s, and he would teach seminars on how to use PageMaker, Photoshop, and programs like that. And he was one of the rare guys that could make something like software seem fun. I always enjoyed it. I thought, this guy's a really good teacher, and he's a great artist. So one time after one of his seminars in Tampa, I pulled him aside, and I said, I've got this idea for this association, and I would be sending them an ad every month. So would you be interested in helping me design those ads? He got really excited about it, right? So he became my first art director. He was running a little graphic design shop. He continually fired his clients until it was just us. I was the last client. Then he launched the National Association of Photoshop Professionals, NAP. Instead of charging $99 per month, he charges $99 per year.
Mm-hmm.
He has 80,000 members. He does his convention. He does an East Coast and a West Coast convention, and they have I think they're doing something. I can't give you the dollar figures. I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. But he has literally thousands of attendees, and he is now sold over 1 million books related to software, and is the best-selling author in that category. And it's a very competitive category.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been an amazing success, and I give him all the credit, but I sure like to tell that story because it makes me feel proud.
Oh, yeah. I could see why. Absolutely. And then, so at its height, you had 2,200 schools. Then you sold the association. And can you give us at least an idea of what you sold for or anything like that?
Not as much as I would have liked to.
Okay.
But enough to where I basically went under the radar for the past few years, and I'm getting motivated to, when I started NAMA, I had been teaching for nearly 20 years, about 15 years. I've been teaching for about 15 years, and I was getting really bored. I was no longer challenged by running these schools with 600 students. And the key was one day I was running a black belt exam, and this is a test. It's a four-hour exam, very physical, where students are testing for their black belt. It's a huge day in their martial arts career. It's the biggest day. My brothers showed up, and they said, hey, we have tickets to the Yankees game, spring training game. It starts in 1 hour in Tampa. I thought, wow, I got to get this test over fast so I can go to the game. Then I thought, that's a really bad thought to have. This is the biggest day for these students, and you're thinking about sneaking out and going to a baseball game. Mm. At that point, I realized I needed a new challenge. Mm. I needed the national platform. That's why NAMA was so attractive to me. I could really sink my teeth into it.
Mm-hmm.
And at this stage, I feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm ready for the next platform, and that's why I wrote The Imposter Syndrome, and that's why I'm starting to speak at colleges, and I'm getting back out there again in a different arena.
Who do you feel is like your core niche for what you're doing now?
I'm targeting college students mm-hmm. for speaking engagements. I just got back from the APCA event in Houston where I did a presentation on black belt leadership. It went over great. I feel that the strategies and mental strategies and decision-making processes that I've learned in my martial arts training and my business success is exactly what someone in college needs to learn, high school, college. It's ideal for them because they're at a very impressionable age. They can go in any direction, and I certainly want to help influence them in the right direction. However, my local programs, like the Quantum Leap program, is more geared towards small business owners. I've been doing it for years in the martial arts with martial artists coming in. Now I'm opening it up to small business people locally and authors and people of that nature,
mm-hmm.
where we meet every 3 months and spend the day together training and then setting new goals and reviewing last month's goals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a very fun process for me as well. I'm just, by nature, I'm a teacher, and that's when I'm most happy and satisfied, when I'm in front of a group of people and sharing some of the things that I've learned.
Hey, let me ask you this. What did you learn? What would be some things that you really took away from your work with Tony Robbins? What are some techniques or things you've learned from Tony Robbins that you really would highly recommend to authors, speakers, coaches?
The two parts there. One, oddly enough, as much as I like him personally and he's the best speaker I've ever seen, and that would be it. Learn to become an excellent speaker like Tony Robbins. Learn how to communicate your passion like he does. He has a background in hypnosis. I have a background in hypnosis. He has a background in NLP. I have a background in NLP. So there's lots of parallels to what he's doing, but rather than teaching NLP, he's basically doing it on the crowd, much like Barack Obama did. He had franchises for a while, and they would bring me in to do a Fear into Power seminar where they would write their fear down on a board, and I would teach them how to break the board. It was kind of like the local version of the Firewalk, and it was very popular, very effective. However, in terms of skills that I've applied in my career, Brian Tracy's the guy. That guy has really taught me so much that I feel indebted to him. He's been so good to me. He was on my board for the martial arts organization. He's endorsed my books. He wrote the foreword for my last book. He has just been great. And what I love about Brian Tracy is that he is straightforward. He doesn't mince words. He is articulate. He's sharp. We have similar backgrounds. He didn't graduate high school. He was a martial artist. He got a lot out of the arts, the character development side. And he has just been so good to me through the years. And I feel like a long-distance mentee of his.
Mm.
And I try and acknowledge that everywhere I go. And Tony has been, too. I mean, Tony was on my TV show. He did my keynote presentation, and it was fantastic. I mean, the guy is just a superb speaker. So I guess you could say the skill set was taught to me by Brian, and I more emulate Anthony Robbins because I've just never seen a more dynamic speaker than that guy.
There's one thing, and Brian writes about so many different things. In fact, I spoke at an event that Brian was speaking at and had lunch with him about 2 years ago, and you're right, he gives so much great content. If there's one thing that you remember learning from Brian about, whether it was managing time or being more persuasive, what's kind of one of your favorite, like, ahas that you've gotten?
Well, it's interesting because in my book, I make a third reference to a guy named John Anderson, who's a lead singer for the band Yes, and he's always spoken about similar things. Oddly enough, Brian's big deal was there's no middle ground. You imagine there's a ledger of success, and you draw a line down the center. Either you're doing things that are moving you closer to your goal, or you're moving things that take you further away. And that was really strong for me. That had a big impact on me. And then years later, I heard the lyric, "You are the move you make," which is the title of my last chapter in the book. And literally, you are the move you make every single day. And going back to the imposter syndrome analogy we talked about earlier, your life is defined by the patterns of thought and behaviors. Not what you say, clearly it's what you do. And the key to success in many ways is to start recognizing what patterns of thought may be holding you back, like those rules we talked about earlier, those shoulds we discussed earlier that become mental breaks in your personal, professional life, and then redefine those. And it's not easy to do. It takes a while, but I certainly did it, and I'm sure our listeners can as well.
Hmm. Well, this is great. I really appreciate just all the wonderful information and inspiration you're giving my folks. We want to encourage them to go to johngraden.com. Anything else to add here before we close?
No, I've watched you through the years. I remember when we were just getting started, and I've watched your company grow, and I appreciate what you're doing for authors out there. It's inspired me, it's educated me, and it sure has made a big difference for me. So keep it up, Steve.
Well, thanks, John. And hey, you motivated me to go check out martial arts now.
There you go.
Well, I really appreciate your doing just a great interview here, and looking forward to seeing you again soon.
Cool. Great. Thanks so much.